National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and that means we're here for another episode of National Security This Week. We get together here on KYMN Radio every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore American national security. I have just a couple of notes to share before we get started today. First, it happens to be United Nations World Oceans Day today. It's a simple effort to bring attention to the health of our oceans on planet Earth. For those of you who watch the TV show Sunday Morning on CBS each week, toward the end of this past Sunday's show, they had a segment on the amount of heat and carbon dioxide the oceans have trapped over the past 50 years, and the fact that the oceans are starting to hit a tipping point where they can't manage the impacts of human-caused climate change. That'll be sort of a double whammy for planet Earth when the oceans start to acidify and warm. I recommend watching that segment. It was highly educational. On a happier note, today happens to be the 62nd wedding anniversary for my friends Sharon and Ordeen Anderson. Happy anniversary, you two. Many more to come. All right, now let's go ahead and get started. We've seen some globally significant events transpire over the past 4 months. Russia invaded Ukraine, and the NATO alliance, the European Union, and liberal democracies around the world responded with aggressive sanctions on Russia and significant aid for Ukraine. In the midst of this global security crisis, democratic elections continued. France saw a heated race for president between incumbent Emmanuel Macron and challenger Marine Le Pen. Northern Ireland had elections for their assembly, and for the first time, Sinn Féin took a majority of seats. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has received blistering attacks from the opposition over his handling of COVID-19 in the UK and the behavior of his staff during lockdown, all while he rallies support for Ukraine. And just yesterday, he survived a no confidence vote in Parliament. Germany has made an abrupt about-face on defense policies as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And finally, Finland and Sweden submitted applications to officially join NATO, also because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It's been a tumultuous period, to say the least. With us to discuss these events is Dr. Devashree Gupta. Dev Gupta is a professor of political science at Carleton College, where she has taught since 2006. She holds a Bachelor of Arts in Government from Georgetown University, a Master's in International Relations from the University of Chicago, and a Doctorate in Government from Cornell University. Her research interests include the internal politics of nationalist and separatist movements, especially the relations between moderate and militant factions, as well as social movements and protest behavior more broadly. Her geographic area of specialty is Western Europe, with a particular focus on the politics of the United Kingdom and Ireland. Her current research projects include an analysis of strategic redirections in Northern Ireland's Republican movement and the conditions under which tactical change might contribute to the formation of splinter groups and intra-movement rivals. Dr. Dev Gupta, welcome back to National Security This Week.
Thanks so much, John. It's a pleasure to be back.
We had you on, I think it was October last year.
Yes,
does that sound right?
Yeah, that's
we
right.
Talked about the politics in the UK and Northern Ireland.
One
and
of my favorite topics. It was a real treat just to spend an hour just talking about nothing but that.
Well, we'll have an opportunity to talk a little bit more about that today. Let's go ahead and start with the elections. And let's start with France, if we could.
Sure.
Can you frame for our listeners how important the election in France was for the EU, kind of for NATO, and perhaps for the world?
Sure. This was a really closely watched election that was understood to be high stakes, in part because of Marine Le Pen, who is one of the standard bearers for the far right in France, and which had its strongest national showing in this election. I think one of the things to understand, or an important piece of context about France, is how they run their presidential elections. So it's known as a two-round system. That's one of the ways that people describe it. So you have a field of presidential hopefuls that's pretty broad, pretty eclectic, with many more than just two candidates and two parties. So in the first round, we had 12 parties and candidates represented, including parties of the center, parties of the center left and right, and parties of the more far right and far left. But the general pattern is that, you know, if no one wins an outright majority in that first round, then you go to a runoff election where the two top candidates go head to head, and one of them therefore gets 50%.
By majority, do you mean at least 51%?
51%, yes, right. So, you know, in France, historically, this system has meant that in that first round, people can cast ballots for a wide variety of candidates for a wide variety of reasons. And so some people vote in a way that we talk about it as sincere voting, right? They vote for the candidate who is actually really closely aligned to their sincere political preferences and what kinds of policies they want. It also makes it possible for people to vote as a protest move because they know that there's a second round coming up.
Right.
And so the two most feasible candidates will go head to head. And so they'll have another chance to vote. And in that round, people will vote, you know, more strategically. Who's the best of these two people? And so in the general sort of way that these things work, we might imagine that the two candidates with the broadest appeal are the ones that survive to the second round. And in France, for many decades, that first round would get narrowed to candidates of the center-left and candidates of the center-right. And so the Socialist Party is the largest historical center-left party, and then its counterpart on the center-right. But this pattern has really destabilized over time, and voters have turned to newer parties and parties of the far right, including Le Pen's National Rally, and they've really benefited from this. So in this particular election, people were watching not just how Le Pen would do, but also how a challenger to her flank, someone who's even more extreme than her, would do. And that's Eric Zemmour, whose party had garnered some attention because of surging support, the high-profile defection of Le Pen's niece to his ranks, and also because he is more hardline than even Le Pen is. And Marine Le Pen is not considered particularly centrist in any way.
No.
And so there was a lot of interest in the dynamics of this race and whether having two far-right politicians would split that vote, creating an opening for the moderate right to kind of sneak through. That didn't happen, and that just simply underscores the strength of the far-right vote at this moment. And so for people watching that election who are concerned about the implications for democracy, the commitment of France to the European Union, to NATO, to liberal democracy, to, you know, multilateral approaches to international relations, this was a really consequential election. And I would say it's a sobering election in many ways, even though Macron wins and Marine Le Pen doesn't. Because it's an election where the gap between Macron and Le Pen, who went head-to-head in 2017, narrows. And so that's something that people should be watching and taking seriously. And I've heard people say it's only a matter of time before, you know, Marine Le Pen or her successor, whoever that might be, is going to win one of these things and sort of end up in that seat.
So for our listeners, can you sort of describe the differences between those two parties that Macron and Le Pen respectively represent? I mean, kind of what do those parties stand for in France?
Sure. So Macron is a centrist. His policies, he used to be part of the socialist policy, has moved a little bit more to the right. But Macron is really as centrist a politician as you might possibly imagine at this point. And so, you know, his policies have really been aligned with relatively moderate reforms, specifically changes to try and, in some ways, reform the French economy, and also to use economic policies as tools to try and move France in particular directions. And I'm thinking specifically about environmental policy in this particular instance. Some of your listeners might recognize or remember that there was a period of extreme protest in France, sort of touched off at the end of 2018, lasting many months, the so-called yellow vest protesters. Mm-hmm. And they were really protesting, at least it started with some fuel hikes, the price of fuel increased. And this was an attempt by Macron's government to use economic policy levers to try and move towards a greener kind of an economy. Mm-hmm. But of course, these reforms these price hikes hit people in France in different ways, depending on their existing sort of socioeconomic position, but also it opened up a rural-urban divide. Mm. You know, in rural areas, you don't have public transportation as an option. You are much more reliant on the car. I mean, this is familiar in the U.S. as well.
And you have to drive further distances, so exactly. You're going to use more fuel.
Exactly. So it opened up an interesting kind of urban-rural rift. It wasn't just an urban-rural rift, but that, in addition to other policies, tax reforms and efforts by the Macron government, was really seen as penalizing the everyday working class French person and favoring a more urban, elite, economically stratified kind of a population. Marine Le Pen is interesting because her stances have I guess the big story with Marine Le Pen is that her success has been in part a kind of mainstreaming of the far right. So her party is far right based on a number of different indicators. She has pretty strong positions on things like immigration and sort of limiting immigration. She advocates for relatively strong measures that limit, say, wearing of headscarves in public areas or in certain roles. And so that is seen as being an anti-Islamic kind of a stance. You know, there are, you know, certain kinds of ways in which she softened that language, the stance of her party, to make it more about the economic issues facing working people. So trying to bring a little bit more of an economic populism element into it that is not quite so distinctly far right, but actually plays well with people who might vote for left parties as well. So with Eric Zemmour and his party appearing, which is a little bit less of an economic populist party and much more about the kind of cultural politics of the far right, it seemed like there was being a distinction made between the more mainstreaming far right of Marine Le Pen and Eric Zemmour. However, once you get to that second round of the presidential election, Eric Zemmour loses, he throws his full support behind Marine Le Pen, and it becomes clear that, you know, the softening, this mainstreaming, is really just a surface-level kind of a phenomenon.
So Marine Le Pen's party, could you frame them as nationalistic, populist, sort of xenophobic to a certain extent?
Oh, definitely xenophobic, not even to a certain extent.
And if she were to win, or her successor were to win in future elections, are we likely to see France trying to pull out of the EU, sort of like the Brits did and with Brexit?
Yeah, I don't know if I would necessarily predict that. You know, the UK has historically been a lot more Eurosceptic,
sure.
And because of their geography and because they're not tied into the Eurozone and because they're not tied into the Schengen free movement area, it in principle is a little bit easier to extract them because they are not as involved in all of these other institutions and rules. France is, right? It's part of the Eurozone. It's part of Schengen. So I think it would be a little bit trickier to extract them. That doesn't mean that a Eurosceptic like Marine Le Pen or her successor wouldn't want to try. And Britain's given them a blueprint now,
sure.
Right? So now we see that it's possible and maybe some of the ways in which they could do it. I think that, you know, certainly there would be interest in trying to push back on some of the ways in which Brussels limits national sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the ways in which Marine Le Pen and people like Nigel Farage in the UK, people like Viktor Orban, who I think we're going to be talking about later, they really see themselves as champions of national sovereignty, right? And so thinking about, you know, what is good for France doesn't necessarily mean that you give up ground to the European Union. In fact, quite the opposite.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. We'll see what Macron has his work cut out for him.
Yeah, that's
as
true.
A centrist.
I mean, I do think one or two other observations that I think why we should care about the French case is that it's part of this continuing populist surge in elections mm-hmm. around the world. You know, we've seen it in the U.S. with Trump's election, and then also with successive politicians who emulate Trump's playbook. But they're also populists on the left. It's not just a right-wing phenomenon. And in Europe, much of the populism in the past three decades has been from the right wing. You know, we see right-wing populist politicians who have won elections in at the European level, at the executive level, at the legislative level in places like UK, Sweden, Denmark, France, Italy, Austria, Hungary, Greece, and more. And that's a pretty wide selection of countries, pretty old and pretty stable democracies, younger democracies, richer countries, poorer countries. And in the and so what I think is sort of interesting about the French election is that you have, of the top three candidates who came top the list in the first round, you have Macron, the centrist, you have a right-wing populist, that's Le Pen, and then you have a left-wing populist who comes in third, and that's Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who came in third with 22% of the vote, just 2 points behind Le Pen. Okay. And so, you know, populism is a force that we should absolutely name and grapple with. But what's interesting to me about the way that the dynamics of the presidential election have unfolded is that right now there's a lot of economic anxiety in France, elsewhere, and this is following on, you know, a couple number of months of really high profile public protests that really start with this economic anxiety. But also include demands for public services and anger over tax cuts that were perceived to benefit the richest people in society. These are issues that it should be easy for politicians of the left to convert into votes, right? This is economic anxiety and inequality are the issues that the left historically claim as theirs. But this didn't happen, right? Not unproblematically. And so many of the yellow vest protesters in the run-up to the election actually signal their support for Le Pen or even the more far-right candidate, Zemmour. And it suggests to me that the populism is sort of the common denominator. It's the thing that's the constant here that's driving a lot of this dynamic. It's the anti-establishment candidate who talks about politics not being business as usual, who promises to shake things up and cut through the governing morass to serve the regular people. And that sounds really democratic in a lot of ways, but in practice, populists tend to prefer limiting deliberation, limiting the number of voices who weigh in on policy and policymaking processes, and most importantly, including limiting the voices that argue for minority perspectives and minority populations. And so there's a preference for action in the name of the people. But in short order, that can lead to a kind of tyranny of the majority and a weakening of institutional norms and institutional rules that are intended to keep political power in check. Right?
Yeah.
Checks and balances are annoying if they slow you down from what you want, but it assumes that at some point you or your preferred politician will not be in power, because that's the sort of bargain of democracy. Sometimes you lose. And those are the rules that actually protect us as well.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things that I am thinking about when I look at France.
Yeah, I can tell you, in the 21 years that I served as an intelligence officer in the Navy, all the intel analysts out there in the U.S. intelligence community, whenever a nation around the world would move towards a populist political leader or start advocating on behalf of sort of nationalist rhetoric, we always started watching those countries much more intently, because there was a destabilization of sort of the democratic process that was taking place when those movements started to gain traction.
Yeah.
You had to watch those countries because you knew there was trouble brewing.
Yep, absolutely.
So you're known at Carleton for your course on the Troubles in Northern Ireland. My introduction included your studies of the IRA and the peace deal that ended the conflict in Northern Ireland. What does it mean that the political party Sinn Féin won the most seats in the Northern Ireland Assembly elections? Maybe you could tell us a little about, you know, what Sinn Féin is and why it matters so much that they might be taking the political lead in Northern Ireland.
Sure. Okay. So a little bit of context. So Northern Ireland is part of the UK, as we know, but the UK has what we call a devolved form of government. So there's a parliament in London. That's the beautiful building with Big Ben at the end that everyone sort of recognizes. And that is still the supreme legislative body. But that parliament has chosen to grant certain self-governing powers to three regions, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, all of which now have their own parliaments and have had since 1997, with limited power to make laws. So Northern Ireland, the Assembly is the regional parliament, and it can legislate over things like housing, education, healthcare policy, agricultural policy, etc. There are certain things that are considered reserved so that they're politically fraught, and so the parliament in Northern Ireland is not really supposed to deal with them. Policing and security issues being one of them, given the history in Northern Ireland. But one important piece of context to understand Sinn Féin's election.
And who is Sinn Féin?
Oh, sorry. Sinn Féin is one of the four largest political parties in Northern Ireland. And the key facts to know about them is that one is that they're the political arm of the Irish Republican Army, or the Irish Republican Army is officially disbanded, but they were, for all of their history, really linked to the IRA. They are a pro-unification with Ireland party. That is one of the most important pieces of their political platform. And the people who support Sinn Féin tend to be, they call themselves nationalists. They want unification with Ireland, which they see as their rightful national home. And it tends to be a mostly, although not fully, Catholic population. And Northern Ireland has a historic divide between Catholics, who generally want to be united with Ireland, and Protestants, who generally want to be united with Great Britain. And so the one sort of slightly more technical piece to understanding Northern Ireland is, in 1997, there was a peace agreement called the Belfast Agreement, which was signed to bring an end to 30 years of conflict, which we refer to as the Troubles. And one key element of this agreement was how this Northern Ireland Assembly would be structured, so that the two sides, the nationalist and unionist, Catholic and Protestant sides, would work together. Historically, there was a parliament in Northern Ireland that was a sort of holdover from, you know, when all of Ireland was part of the UK, and, you know, I don't know how much detail you want, but
before Irish independence, anyway.
Yes, and so. You know, so there was, and the British government sort of largely left matters of Northern Ireland's governance in the hands of this local parliament through, you know, since 1921 to the 1960s, when the Troubles really get going. And so in this period with this parliament, the Protestants, who were a numerically larger population, had complete dominance. And so the Catholic representing parties would never be able to stop anything from happening. So they were kind of an inert force. And so one of the worries was, how do you actually get this parliament in Northern Ireland post-peace process to work together? So one of the ways in which the peace agreement structured this is that the two largest political parties, one representing the unionists and one representing the nationalists, would have to work together to govern. And there would be no other option. In order to form an executive, you have to work together. And if one party refuses for whatever reason, the executive can't function. So it's pretty high stakes. And there have been instances in the past where the two main parties have not been able to work together. So in Northern Ireland, this provision and the natural division between the unionist and nationalist sides means that the major electoral competition is intra-community. So what matters more is who the Catholics are voting for, Sinn Féin or their rival, the SDLP, and who the unionists are voting for, the largest political party on that side, the Democratic Unionist Party, or their rival, the Ulster Unionist Party, because almost no one really crosses that divide, right? You don't really find examples of many Catholics deciding that they're going to vote for the Protestant parties or vice versa. So when the peace agreement was signed, one long-term story in Northern Ireland that helps provide context for why this election is so interesting and consequential is that there's been a gradual erosion of the moderate parties on either side in each community, and erosion in favor of the more militant political parties. So after the peace agreement was signed, the largest nationalist party was the SDLP. Moderate, constitutional, has always eschewed violence, you know, involved in negotiations with the British government throughout the Troubles to kind of bring an end to it. And the Ulster Unionist Party, their counterpart. Over time, they've lost power. They've lost votes. They've lost seats. And the net winners have been Sinn Féin, the more militant nationalists, and the DUP, the more militant unionists. And this has made it hard to work together in the executive, because we imagine the moderates can more easily come to a bargain with each other than the militants on either side, in part because, you know, their voters tend to reward militancy. So it doesn't really work as well for them if they have to bargain. So Sinn Féin became the dominant party on the nationalist side in 2003. So that's not a new story. What's interesting about this is that they're no longer the second largest party. They're the largest party.
Right.
And so one of the ways in which we might think about this is, what does this potentially tell us about their about the underlying demographics of Northern Ireland? And this is a fraught issue, right? Because one of the sort of assumptions is a main reason why Northern Ireland is still in the UK and not hurtling towards reunification with Ireland is that there are still more Protestants in Northern Ireland than there are Catholics. Well, we don't actually know what the current numbers are until the 2021 census releases the data.
Okay.
But the trends over time have been really clear. That gap has been narrowing over time, in part because the Catholic population has a higher birth rate.
Sure.
So, you know, that's a possibility. But I was looking at some analysis out of the London School of Economics that suggests that the unionist bloc of parties still has a net voter advantage, but it is paper thin. So the numbers I saw was something like a net advantage of 6,400 votes. Right. So paper thin. So slim and eroding, but still numerical advantage. So there is an interesting sort of dynamic here about what might be happening in terms of people's shifting preferences and the ways in which Brexit in particular has kind of fragmented what's been going on the unionist side, which makes it possible for Sinn Féin to kind of just leap over them, just leapfrog over them. Mm-hmm. Because the thing that, you know, I want to sort of stress two things that seem contradictory. One is that this is a pretty important and significant election, and Sinn Féin becoming the largest political party in Northern Ireland is huge.
Right.
They did that without increasing their share of seats. So in 2017, they won something like, what's the number? I have it here somewhere. They had 27 seats out of 90. And in 2022, they have 27 seats out of 90. So they didn't actually increase the number of seats at all. The unionists have decreased the number of seats. And the net winner in the net biggest gain was a party called the Alliance Party, which is a non-sectarian centrist party. So there's some interesting dynamics we can talk about and how they've benefited from the brouhaha over Brexit.
We'll have to see how that shakes up over the next couple of years, I guess.
Yes.
So you mentioned the Brexit vote pulling the United Kingdom out of the European Union. There had been the Scots had held an independence vote, I think not long after that, and they voted to remain in the United Kingdom. Sinn Féin becoming a more powerful political party in Northern Ireland. Do you see if they gain enough power, will they force a referendum vote in Northern Ireland to unify with, or at least pull out of the United Kingdom, maybe unifying with Northern Ireland?
It's a really interesting question. One correction, the Scottish referendum was in 2014.
So 2014,
this was before Brexit.
Okay.
I actually think it's a fair question that if the referendum in Scotland had happened after Brexit, if we would have already be looking at the dissolution of the UK.
So.
I think so too. Yeah. You know, given how much more strongly Scotland came out on the Remain side for Brexit, I think one of the discussions in 2014 was, we just don't know if pulling out of the UK would allow Scotland to enter the EU. And it was always clear that Scotland would want to enter the EU as an independent country. Well, you know, it was unknown whether that would happen. There were reasons to think that it would be hard to do because Spain, for one, would not want to set a precedent of a breakaway region joining the EU. So one of the arguments that was made in 2014 was better to stay in the UK where we're in the EU than leave the UK and then not be able to get in the EU. Well,
right.
When the UK leaves the EU, then that argument becomes absolutely powerless. So
right.
Anyway, I think this is a really interesting election to think about that. But I do think it is important to recognize that the result that we're talking about with Sinn Féin becoming this largest party is still the result of relatively small shifts, right, in the number of seats. So it's important, but it's not earth-shattering in some ways. Sinn Féin didn't increase their share of seats. They did increase their share of the overall vote, but that's just by 1%. So
Okay. We're
not talking about huge things. It's the story in the unionist side that I think is interesting. And they start to splinter a little bit because there are real I think, anxieties on the unionist side about how Brexit has really changed the landscape for Northern Ireland. You might remember that one of the things that we talked about when I was last here is the way in which Brexit sort of brings to the surface a pretty agonized conversation about land borders and where the custom borders between the UK and the EU should be. Mm-hmm. Right? So that you have to have some place to inspect goods coming out and into the EU. And the two main choices that were offered were both controversial. So you put the customs border where the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland is. That becomes a relatively hardened border with checkpoints and security, and that made the nationalists very upset because then it really reinforces that Northern Ireland is separate from the rest of Ireland. They don't want that to be the case. The alternative of putting the customs border in the Irish Sea so that you have checkpoints and checks at the Northern Ireland, Welsh and Scottish ports made the unionists mad because then that really reinforces the idea that Northern Ireland is not really part of the rest of the UK. Well, the unionists lost that particular battle, and so the customs border is in the north, in the Irish Sea. And this has been a sore spot for the unionists. There have been protests. This has been an issue. And so what this means now is the largest unionist party, the militants, the DUP, have to agree to form an executive with Sinn Féin. And they have so far signaled that they would be unwilling to do so until the Brexit protocol is revisited.
Okay.
So, and this kind of impasse has happened before, not with Brexit, but in the past, this has led to the executive kind of being inert, not being able to function. And that has actually meant that some of the governance that normally would happen at the Northern Ireland regional level gets shifted back to the British level in Westminster. And actually, no one wants that to happen. So this is going to be an interesting game of chicken to see how far the DUP is willing to go. But this issue of independence is such an interesting one. It's certainly the fear that unionists have at this particular moment, I would say.
Yeah.
I personally don't think it's imminent. Under the terms of the peace agreement, a referendum can be called if there's reason to believe a majority of the population in Northern Ireland wish for reunification. That's a call that the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland makes. That's a cabinet-level official in the British government. And I don't think we're there yet. So I was looking at some polling data just from December. So not, absolutely current, but not that long ago. And this was polling that was done on both sides of the border because the wishes of the Republic are not irrelevant to this discussion either.
Sure.
And Sinn Féin, by the way, is a pretty major political party in the Republic of Ireland as well. They're the only political party that is an all-Ireland party. They run candidates on both sides of that border. And so, for Sinn Féin, reunification is important for the principle alone, but they're also wanting reunification to happen in such a way that they can set themselves up to be an obvious player in a new United Ireland, right? So the terms of that and the conditions under which that happens is also going to be important for them. So in the Republic, in this December polling data, 62% favor unification, but don't see it happening right away. And so the poll, the Irish Times poll, asked about a likely time frame, and the most popular answer was sometime in the next decade.
Okay.
Okay. So then there was a similar poll in the north. A majority think that there should be a border poll at some point in the future, which is pretty imprecise. And if pressed, 2/3 of those surveyed thought that if it were held in about a decade, it would likely pass. Okay. But if it were held today, there would be no chance of it passing.
Sure.
And I think there are lots of reasons for that. Even people who self-identify as Irish and nationalist might have some questions about how it would work to transition from the British National Health Service to the Irish Health Service. The NHS is seen to be, better equipped and better resourced by some, not all. Unemployment benefits are more generous in the UK. If we're heading into a global recession, sorry, I've said the R word, but if we're heading into sort of a prolonged period of economic unrest, that's not a small consideration. But I also think that longer term, especially among young people, and possibly young people of both Catholic and Protestant communities, there's a sense that maybe life under the EU might be better than life in a post-Brexit Britain.
Oh, right.
Because of the economic opportunities, the travel, the you know, the EU is a much larger trading bloc than Britain by itself. You know, so the kinds of trade deals it can strike, the kind of negotiating power it has is really different. But COVID makes it complicated because we don't really know what a post-Brexit Britain really looks like. You know,
that's true.
we can't really discern a signal because there's so much COVID noise, right?
Right.
So I think there's a sense of a ticking clock. It's going to put some pressure on Sinn Féin to soften the ground and then for the unionists to hold that ground. And so what I'm interested in thinking about and watching for is how paramilitaries on both sides, and they haven't gone away despite the peace process, how they might see this moment as either an opportunity or a threat, right? And how they might justify stepped up activity in those terms.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll just say is, as for Scotland, I think the issue of a referendum in Scotland is always on the table, especially when the Scottish National Party does well in elections. But the most recent polling that I saw suggested that Northern Ireland is more invested in Scotland having a referendum than people in Scotland, 66% to 56%. So there's something interesting there. You know, the thing I would just sort of underscore, though, is that it's possible to look at Northern Ireland's elections as a bellwether for Scotland, as a bellwether for this question about constitutional status, about whether the UK should basically, you know, break up the band and sort of go in different directions. But I think elections also have to do with other really mundane questions, and it's hard to separate some of those things out sometimes. So Sinn Féin's election rhetoric, and everyone knows that Sinn Féin wants unification with Ireland. This is known. It is not a question. They have never backed away from it, right? It is part of their core identity. But in this election, they also put a lot of economic issues front and center, like really basic bread and butter, you know, how do you manage in the home that you have, not the home that you want, kind of way. And they kind of downplayed some of the big constitutional issues. So again, Sinn Féin clearly cares about it. But it also wants to demonstrate that it's not a one-issue party.
Okay.
Right? That it wants to demonstrate that it's a competent governing force that cares about the things that people care about when it comes to, you know, trash pickup and making the schools work and making sure that, you know, there are functional public services and all of these things. You know, they don't want to tie themselves to the one issue that becomes irrelevant if they manage to achieve independence. If they're only about independence and then you get independence, then what else do you have to offer the voters?
Yeah. Well, there's going to be a lot to watch, Northern Ireland and even Scotland, and how the United Kingdom functions once we do kind of finish with COVID and they have to stand on their own.
Yep. I'm also watching Wales because there have been some pro-independence Welsh politicians who have been making some noise, and no one really takes Welsh independence all that seriously when you've got Northern Ireland and Scotland to talk about. But we shouldn't forget about Wales, even though they're smaller and much more tied to the UK, to England and to British politics. But, you know, we talk about a rise of populism in the world. We should also talk about the rise of nationalism in the world. We're living in an intensely nationalistic moment.
Yeah.
And when we talk about nationalism, we're often thinking about its most virulent and violent and exclusionary forms. Well, you know, in Scotland and Wales, at least, that nationalism hasn't, you know, historically taken predominantly violent forms. It hasn't taken predominantly xenophobic sort of forms, not in the way that we might see in well, we'll talk about Ukraine and Hungary and some of these other places in just a little bit.
We'll have a little shortened time to do that. We have about 20 minutes left.
But nationalism is still a force there, too.
Yeah. So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Devrashee Gupta from Carleton College, and we're discussing recent elections in Western Europe and implications for European security. Let's talk a little bit about the crisis in Ukraine, if we could. As someone who studied European security issues, could you have predicted how quickly the EU and NATO would come together to enact sanctions and really robust sanctions against Russia and Belarus over Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
It was a surprise to me, I will be honest, in part because Russia's engaged in brinksmanship in Ukraine before and over Crimea and then in Georgia as well. And we haven't seen the kind of unified and clear response. So I think a number of people were surprised. I think Putin was surprised.
Right. He's probably the most surprised.
Right. I mean, if the past is prologue, we would not have predicted that the Western democracies would come together in this way, in this particular instance, especially since a lot of those players have, pretty big fractious domestic issues that sort of pull them away from these sorts of issues, this particular crisis. And I suspect Putin assumed that as well.
Well, Boris Johnson, Emmanuel Macron, they both had lots of things on their plates.
Absolutely.
And they have been some of the champions of support. So for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? Newton's third law. So Putin orders the invasion of Ukraine. The EU and the NATO nations suddenly find their footing, and the alliance is rapidly strengthened against a common foe. Even Germany alters their thinking about German national defense priorities. Germany had been woefully inadequate in their spending on their own national defense for quite some time. What can you tell us about Germany's political situation before the Russian invasion? We all heard about Nord Stream 2 and why it was such a bad idea, that it's an economic and an energy issue. But it was also a security issue for Germany, because economic security is national security. And Germany and Russia have been profoundly linked for, economically and even politically for some time now. Angela Merkel tried her best to have a good working relationship with Vladimir Putin because of these energy issues. How much of an about face has it been for Germany turning their backs really on Russia as a result of the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
Yeah, it's in so many ways a pretty big change, right? It's changed the Germany has changed its policy on never sending weapons to conflict zones.
Right.
That's a very, very big shift, and it really sort of signals a kind of a transformation of their stance of like not wanting to contribute, to a more militant response when like negotiations and talk and engagement through trade are ways that they have preferred to wield their sort of foreign policy might, and this kind of change through trade, right? This policy of engagement rather than balancing has been something that has been such a deeply rooted feature of German politics in this post-war period. And they've done well with sort of working through and banking on global engagement, globalization, trade, but all of that is built upon an assumption that you have a rules-based order.
Right.
And so what they're confronting now is this very tangible example that you've got some bad actors who do not play by those rules.
Right.
And playing by the rules when your opponents are not playing by the rules is a sucker's game.
Right. That's a good way to put it. So we know that, Boris Johnson, Emmanuel Macron, and Germany's Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, seem to be providing pretty strong European leadership in handling this Russia-Ukraine situation. What challenges do they have across the rest of Europe for both the EU component and the NATO component with regard to Turkey, as it's now supposed to be called, and Hungary, both of which have proven, I'll say, complicated for the alliance and for the efforts to oppose Russia?
Yeah, so let's start with Hungary. Viktor Orban in Hungary is a complicated politician. he's a populist. That's the sort of first and most important thing that I would say about him. And what that means, and populism is this sort of very malleable, flexible kind of ideological strategy. It pairs with left-wing politics, it pairs with right-wing politics, but the main kind of way of thinking about the world in populist terms is that there's an us and a them, and it's usually cast in terms of a corrupt elite versus a virtuous people. And the populist leader is the champion of the virtuous people in the face of this corrupt elite. And politics is seen as kind of the zero-sum game and cast in very moralistic terms, a good versus evil kind of a guise. So even before this crisis, Orban wields populism really effectively. And for him, the main other, the main evil elite is Brussels, right? It's the European Union. But more broadly than that, the EU sort of stands in for the liberal West. And so he has this rhetoric that's worked really well for him in domestic politics, that he is sort of championing the sort of forces that want to challenge this liberal order. And so that kind of pattern meets the alliance against Putin, which is framed as the stand of the liberal West against liberal autocrats like Putin specifically, but also sure. He becomes a stand-in for illiberalism. So then you've got Viktor Orban, who on one hand is a member of the EU, he has to comply with EU sanctions, and he has. That's the thing that's sort of complex about him and perplexing about him is that, Germany in some sense has voiced more doubts about sanctions compared to Hungary.
Right.
And Hungary has complied, right? But at the same time, he is explicitly someone who admires illiberalism, is skeptical of the West and its model of democracy. So the rhetoric and the reality are kind of interestingly divergent. And Hungary is tied to the EU economically. So there are some real penalties for going too far down the road of bucking the EU. Mm-hmm. The State Department said something like 89% of Hungary's foreign direct investment comes from the EU, and Germany is the largest investor. China's a pretty minor investor, and Russia's actually not even a minor investor. So there's an interesting kind of reality that Viktor Orban has to deal with. Ukraine and Hungary have strained relations before the war as right. well. And so, there are multiple reasons for this, but one of them is that, Ukraine has this law to limit or block sort of use of minority languages. And Viktor Orban really sees himself and his government as sort of a champion of minority Hungarian populations, sort of human rights outside of Hungary. And so this is one area where this kind of comes into a clash. What I'm really watching when it comes to Orban is the way in which his stance on anti-EU sort of pushback against the sort of liberal values that the EU is meant to sort of champion and his stance on Ukraine have brought him into some tensions with his other fellow unruly children in the EU. So Poland is the one that I'm particularly interested in because sure. Poland is another country that is sort of anti-EU, despite being in the EU, kind of has a populist kind of a streak to it, has argued against the kind of liberal model of the West, and yet Poland is very squarely within the alliance to support Ukraine.
Yes, yes.
Right. So this kind of daylight that has opened up between Hungary and Poland is a really interesting one to kind of think about. Turkey is an interesting case. I'm curious about your thoughts on Turkey too, but Erdogan is also a populist. I think that the predominant reading in Europe is that his opposition to NATO expansion in particular has roots in domestic politics, that he is playing to a domestic audience. He's got an election coming up in 2023, legislative elections, presidential elections. The economy is not in good shape in Turkey. And so therefore kind of signaling that it has this sort of strong role that other actors take it seriously is something that could play really well. And from all accounts, this the stance against NATO expansion in the case of Sweden and Finland has played pretty well. I haven't seen that much being discussed about vocal opposition to this stance. So, the us versus them kind of stance that this has allowed him to kind of set up has worked for him so far.
Yeah, and I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the show, but we did have Ambassador Ross Wilson on a couple months ago, and he had actually served as U.S. ambassador to Turkey. So he was quite familiar with Turkey. He knew Erdogan back then when he was the U.S. ambassador. And he had some great insights into what's driving a lot of the politics in Turkey. The phrase was they want to be the subject of the sentence, not the object of the sentence.
Yep.
So,
when I think about some of the things that that I've been sort of following when it comes to Turkey's their strategy in this particular instance, right? It seems to be in part about the kind of respect that Turkey thinks it is owed.
Right.
Right. And so it's not just about Sweden shutting down fundraising opportunities for people affiliated with the PKK, the Kurdish separatists and their related organizations, not just about complying with extradition requests, but also not visibly seen to support them, right, and to celebrate, you know, people affiliated with them. So there's a sense of, you know, we deserve more obvious respect and standing, right? I think that's a psychological piece of this, too.
I think that's spot on, frankly. And if you look at a lot of the language that Erdogan has used about Finland and Sweden being admitted into NATO, I mean, it's tough language, his accusations towards the governments in Sweden and Finland, specifically about the Kurds. And I know there's a Kurdish member of parliament in Sweden who has his particular ire. I personally think that a lot of this is focused on playing to the domestic politics side to show how strong he is. But I think there's what he's really angling for is to get Turkey out from under sanctions for having purchased the Russian S-400 surface-to-air missile system. They got bounced out of the F-35 program, which is a joint, well, it's a combined program across many, many nations, NATO nations as well, to give them this, you know, fifth-generation fighter aircraft. And Turkey got bounced out of that. He wants back in. I think he wants some of those other sanctions removed. So we'll see how the negotiations go. I know that the Finns and the Swedes have had diplomats in Ankara talking as a good game, trying to figure out how to fix this.
Yeah, and I think diplomacy is something that can yield big dividends in this particular instance.
That's right. So unfortunately, we're starting to run a little low on time. There is one question I want to ask you on an economic side, and then I'm going to give you the floor to tell us what else we should know. But if you look at the situation in Ukraine, Russia's taking a beating from Ukrainian forces. Russia's economy is really taking a hit right now. I think some of those things, I mean, Russia, there are countries out there like China and others who have not tapped into the sanctions regime. They're really giving Russia an outlet for a lot of their oil and grains and things like that. But the EU recently committed 220 billion euros to end their reliance on Russian oil and natural gas, as well as coal for power and for heat generation. Nord Stream 2 is kind of a dead issue for Germany. It's possible that Nord Stream 1, the original pipeline that went from St. Petersburg over to Germany, may also be coming to an end if the EU doesn't successfully enact this effort to wean themselves off Russian fossil fuels. I know that the EU had a goal of 2030 to be heavily committed to green hydrogen fuel as an energy infrastructure. So maybe this whole Russian invasion of Ukraine has really spurred them to move a lot faster. How hard is it going to be for the EU and the NATO members, because not every country in Europe is a member of the EU or a member of NATO, but to weather these economic challenges that we're seeing right now as we try to hold fast on sanctions for Russia?
I mean, it's going to be hard, right? And you know, the domestic will to accept the higher cost of things,
right,
which, and that higher cost is would be happening right now for lots of reasons not connected to Ukraine at all, right? I mean, there is a there's a pandemic related sort of spike in inflation, and you know, there's money chasing fewer goods all over the place, right?
Yeah.
So I think that for a lot of people who are not you know, front sort of seeing this in a sort of firsthand kind of a way, support for Ukraine then gets weighed with pocketbook pressures.
Right.
And that's a classic kind of a problem in political science in general, right? The international foreign policy problem versus the pressures you face at the gas pump, at the grocery store, making rent. And so I think that, you know, as you get closer to winter and fuel becomes important. I mean, even in the summer, if we have a really hot summer and temperatures spike, and so, you know, it becomes important to fuel, you know, cooling and things of the sort. I mean, right, there are all kinds of ways in which domestic populations might decide that actually the thing that is most pressing for their well-being and the focus of their politicians should be something a little bit more domestically focused. And that's the risk that European leaders run right now.
Yeah, and even here in the United States, when Russia first invaded Ukraine, it was hugely popular to do whatever we could to support Ukraine. And when the economic waves started to hit us, that has actually changed. I think the last poll I saw, something like 52% of polled Americans say we should not put our economy on a lesser footing just to save Ukraine.
Right, because defense of the liberal international order is a really abstract thing
it really
to
is.
Fight for, right?
Yeah.
You know, and for most people, this idea of you know, what does it mean to sacrifice for a rules-based international order is relatively distant, even
yeah.
if they benefit from it. They don't see how they benefit
right.
from it. Whereas when you go to the pump and you pay $5 a gallon in gas, that's something that's a pain that feels real
yeah.
and immediate
yes.
and tangible.
yeah.
And so, you know, this is the kind of general assumption in elections is that when the economy is doing well, incumbents do well. When the economy is doing poorly, the incumbents lose. And right now, that holds some. I mean, Biden should be a little bit alarmed by this. I'm sure he is.
yeah.
But, you know, a lot of the commitment to holding some of this alliance together against Russia is underpinned by Boris Johnson, who's in political trouble,
yeah.
by Biden, who is not up for re-election in the next year, and has not sort of like is not going to have a vote of no confidence in the way that Boris Johnson does. The British system is different. The American system doesn't allow for that. But he's going to be anxious about that. So when you know, Macron just recently got elected, so he's got a little bit more time. But this is a real concern, right? When two of the leaders who have been really outspoken about this are themselves facing sort of like political precarity,
yeah.
They're going to pay attention to the signals from the domestic audience in ways that they may not otherwise do if they were a little bit more political secure.
Yeah. We unfortunately only have a few minutes left. I was going to put you on the spot and ask you to make a prediction how the Ukraine situation plays out.
You know, I may have run up the clock to
yeah,
avoid
yeah.
that question
nicely
altogether.
Nicely done, nicely done. I will give you this opportunity to close out the show with any thoughts you have about anything else linked to events in Europe over the last 4 months. What haven't we discussed that caught your eye and should be addressed on our show?
Well, I think one thing just to sort of tie things up with sanctions and Ukraine is that the longer that sanctions are in place, the more sophisticated people and countries become at evading them.
Right.
And so, you know, the sanctions that have been put on Russia are remarkable for how broad they are and how Western powers have been committed to them. But at some point, there's a little bit of a, not a little bit, there's a point of diminishing returns there. And
right.
so I don't know when we're going to reach that, but I think that's something we should be talking about and how, you know, the ways of trying to guard against sort of circumvention of sanctions by using third parties, you know, that needs to be a big part of this conversation going forward.
Yeah, and the Russians are already working
absolutely
aggressively to figure out ways around the sanctions and other countries too.
Yep.
And one of the big things, and we don't have time to talk about it today, but Africa and the Middle East, they rely very heavily on both Russia and Ukraine for grains.
Yes.
And they have to eat.
Yes.
I mean, Egypt, something like 50% of their grain from their wheat comes from Ukraine alone. And they eat a lot of bread in Egypt, and the price for wheat is going through the roof.
Right. And when you have that kind of economic uncertainty and destabilization, it does not bode well
no.
for the politics that follow.
No, that is right. That is right. Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of today's show, today's edition of National Security This Week. Dr. Devashree Gupta, thank you so much for joining us again today. It was a great discussion.
Pleasure as always, John. Thank you.
What do you have planned for the summer?
I am planning a whole slew of research.
All right.
And so I'm looking forward to just getting my hands dirty with that.
Okay. And that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.